most obituaries of former Iraqi dissident and discredited huckster Ahmed Chalabi, who died November 2nd, were straightforward. But as Adam Johnson notes on fair.org, a disconcerting number of outlets took a weird turn, portraying Chalabi as responsible for the U.S. war on Iraq. "Iraqi architect of U.S. invasion is dead," was the headline in the Daily Beast, which claimed Chalabi was, quote, "most remembered for his role in convincing the United States to invade his country," close quote. The New York Times had it that he, quote, "helped persuade the United States to invade Iraq in 2003, close quote. And pundit and Council on Foreign Relations fellow Max Boot claimed Chalabi manipulated the U.S. into war. To be persuaded or manipulated, though, one has to have previously been skeptical or unwilling, and those words just don't apply here. As Paul Waldman reminded in The Week, in the summer of 2002, the White House already had what former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan called a script for a, quote, "campaign to convince Americans that war with Iraq was inevitable and necessary," close quote. Those paying attention know that intelligence on Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction wasn't mistaken, as we commonly hear today. It was, like most intelligence, a mass of contradictions and differing interpretations, from which the administration cherry-picked the parts they wanted to serve that campaign. George W. Bush's own Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, told 60 Minutes in 2004 that Bush, quote, "sought a way to invade Iraq," close quote. Emails show Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair planning the war a year before 9/11. Put simply, the Bush administration didn't need convincing. What it needed was fodder to convince the American public, not all of whom, of course, were ever convinced. And Chalabi and his claims served that function. Of course, as U.S. corporate media were active participants in this disastrous deception, they have every incentive to remember it differently. When you see a piece in elite U.S. media headlined, "Why Denmark Isn't the Utopian Fantasy Bernie Sanders Describes," you probably have a sense of what you're in for. And the Washington Post November 3rd article delivers, with a piece centered on an interview with a British journalist who's written a book that purports to go behind the myth of the Scandinavian utopia. Naturally, proving a place is not utopia is easy work. Michael Booth tells us that the weather in the Nordic countries is appalling, the languages impenetrable, and the food awful. But presumably linking the piece to the U.S. election means we're actually supposed to take it seriously. So it does matter that, as Dean Baker notes on fair.org, the article's pronouncements about Scandinavian societies contain actual misinformation. For example, the Post's interviewer, Anna Swanson, points to a lower proportion of people working as a worrying sign for Denmark's economy and its model. Denmark's employment rate has been declining, but it's still far higher than the United States. If the rate of decline since the 2001 peak continues, it will fall below the current U.S. level in roughly 24 years. And when Booth says that though it's true that Scandinavian countries are the most gender-equal societies in the world, they also record the highest rates of violence towards women, it seems worth noting that Danish women are far less likely to be murdered by their husbands or boyfriends than women in the U.S., a rate of 0.8 per 100,000 compared to 4.7 per 100,000 here. What about relative income equality, free universities, parental leave, subsidized childcare, and a national health system? That just sounds good, Post readers are told. But really, quote, "in Denmark, the quality of the free education and healthcare is substandard. They are way down on the PISA, Program for International Student Assessment, educational rankings, have the lowest life expectancy in the region, and the highest rates of death from cancer. And there is broad consensus that the economic model of a public sector and welfare state on this scale is unsustainable," close quote. You won't be shocked to hear that on both those educational rankings and life expectancy, Denmark is well ahead of the U.S. and there's no evidence presented or requested that that broad consensus exists anywhere outside of Booth's head. So by the time you get to the claim that information on Denmark's public spending, quote, is kept deliberately opaque by the authorities, close quote, though Baker was able to find it quickly on the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's website, you've got the point. The Post doesn't want you getting any silly ideas about looking elsewhere for economic or social models. And if conveying that requires misinforming, well, so be it. And finally, also on the Washington Post, the paper's November 3rd article on the car app Uber is, not to put too fine a point on it, a puff piece. Company VP and spokesperson David Plouffe is permitted to say without challenge things like, quote, Uber can quite literally help transport people out of poverty, offering people affordable rides whenever, wherever they need one, close quote. And to allege, laughably enough, that criticism of the company's practices has flourished, quote, because we haven't gone out there in a full-throated way and engaged in these debates, close quote. As an advertisement for a controversial company, it's got it all. As journalism, it could have used minimally one more thing, a disclosure that Post owner Jeff Bezos is a major Uber investor. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.